Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the remarks by President Obama at the G7 summit, where he criticized the Supreme Court, saying they should not have taken up the second challenge to the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, in a legal challenge Obama described as bizarre, because the law is working, pointing out that the ambiguous phrasing that is the basis of the King versus Burwell case brought by conservative activists could be fixed with a one-sentence provision. A legal scholar who frequently argues before the Supreme Court, Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, joins us to discuss whether Obama is preparing the country for the possibility the Supreme Court will make a politically charged ruling to destroy his signature achievement, resulting in the denial of health care for 6.4 million Americans. Then we'll examine the surprising upset in the Turkish parliamentary elections that thwarted President Erdogan's plans to become the country's all-powerful leader as president of a republic with a weakened parliament and a ceremonial prime minister. Edmund Garib, an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and the first Mustafa Barzani scholar of global Kurdish studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University, joins us to discuss the key role that Turkey's Kurdish party, the People's Democratic Party, played in stopping Erdogan's power grab. Then finally, we'll look into the results of the G7 summit at a castle in the Bavarian Alps, where German Chancellor Angela Merkel managed to get a recalcitrant Japan and Canada to sign onto a commitment to decarbonize the global economy by phasing out the use of fossil fuels by the end of the century. Daniel Kellerman, the Jean Monnet Chair, Director of the Center for European Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University, joins us to discuss the embarrassing comparison that the small German state of Bavaria produces more solar power than the entire United States. And joining us now is Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California. And his books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest, The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erwin Chemerinsky.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
And when the President Obama clearly is peeved, I suppose, is the polite way to put it, at the Supreme Court. And he did in a press conference at the G7, at the close of the G7 summit in Germany, say that this should be an easy case. Frankly, it should not even have been taken up. And of course, he's referring to the second bite of apple that the Supreme Court has in possibly gutting Obamacare. So, is he preparing the nation for the possibility that the Supreme Court could rule against him and destroy his signature achievement?
There's no doubt that the Supreme Court could rule against President Obama, and it would have a devastating effect on the Affordable Care Act. The case is King versus Burwell. It was argued March 4th. It'll be decided by the end of the month. And what it involves is a provision of the Affordable Care Act that says that those who qualify economically get tax credits if they purchase insurance from a state-established exchange. But only 16 states have established exchanges, and the other 34 states, it's the federal government that's created the exchange. And the question is, do people get tax credits if they purchase insurance in these 34 states? If the Supreme Court says no, then the cost of insurance in those exchanges will go up tremendously, the exchanges likely will collapse, and it could bring down the entire law. That's what it's all about.
But this was clearly a lawsuit designed to cripple Obamacare, and the fact that the 34 states didn't create state exchanges and the federal exchange had to fill the void was, I think, largely, and I think the record is pretty clear on this, largely because Republican governors in this state were just against Obamacare.
That's absolutely right. In fact, those who brought this lawsuit said its purpose was to collapse the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. It seems clear that Congress's goal was that anyone who qualified economically would be able to get a tax credit, whether they purchased the insurance from that created by a state government or from the federal government in the states that would not create it. The law says a person gets a tax credit if purchasing insurance from, quote, such exchange. And it's hard to believe that Congress wanted to allow states that didn't want an exchange to ultimately collapse the entire act. But it's before the Supreme Court now, and from the oral argument, it's very difficult to tell which way it's going to come out.
But for it to get to the Supreme Court, it required four of the justices to take this case, which, as I mentioned, appears to be designed to cripple Obamacare. And it's a theory behind the lawsuit is essentially they've seized upon a tiny drafting error. So one has to assume that the four justices who agreed to take this court case are the same four that voted against it the first time around when Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts saved Obamacare.
In 2012, four justices, Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito, would have declared the entire statute, all 2,600 pages of it, to be unconstitutional. We will never know who were the justices that voted to take the case. The court doesn't tell us. But there is the possibility here that the court could deal a lethal blow to the Affordable Care Act. And let's talk about this in human terms. It will mean that millions of people who now have affordable care because of these tax credits will no longer have access to the healthcare system.
But doesn't this have the appearances since the House of Representatives voted something like 56 times to kill this bill? It got to the point where it became a ritual. If the Supreme Court does strike this down on these very, very flimsy legal argument, won't that sort of basically take us back to the situation that President FDR faced with an obstinate and obdurate Supreme Court, where every initiative that he brought forth, particularly those that were designed to save us from or save America from the Great Depression, were struck down by the court? So in other words, what you can't achieve through the legislative branch, you usurp it through the republic, through the judiciary.
Those who lose in the legislative process often then try to challenge the law on constitutional grounds. Liberals and conservatives do that alike. I don't think the analogy to Roosevelt is apt. There, the Supreme Court was striking down a large number of laws. Here, we're talking about one. There, the Supreme Court was declaring laws unconstitutional, so Congress couldn't fix them if they wanted. Here, what the court would be saying is it interprets a federal statute to not apply. In the Roosevelt era, the court was declaring unconstitutional, very popular laws. This is a law that has very mixed reactions to the American people. And this is a law that, in theory, Congress could fix by changing the statutory language. In reality, of course, that won't happen.
Well, the president did mention it, that it just was a one-sentence fix. Clearly, the overall intention of this law is the opposite to what the King versus Burwell advocates are putting forth.
There's no doubt. I think what Congress and the president wanted was to make health care affordable to virtually every American. And the way this did this for a large percentage of Americans, those of lower and lower income, was through tax credits. And Congress wanted to make sure that all who qualified economically be able to purchase insurance through these tax credits. And what the Supreme Court may do is say, in 34 states, people can't get tax credits. That will be a lethal blow to the health care exchanges in these states. And again, in human terms, it will mean millions of people are without health care coverage.
And again, I'm speaking with Owen Chemerinsky, who is the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and at the University of Southern California. And his books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest, The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. So this latest poll by the Washington Post and ABC News indicates that by a margin of 55% to 38%, more people in the United States say that the court should not take action to block federal subsidies in states that didn't set up their own exchanges. And what's interesting about this new poll is that even people who are against Obamacare, particularly Republicans and some independents, still are obviously troubled by the idea that the Supreme Court could rule against it on what does appear to be, you know, rather flimsy and politically motivated grounds.
There's no doubt that the Affordable Care Act is very divisive in the American people. Every Republican in Congress voted against it. And when it went to the lower courts earlier, every judge appointed by a Republican president, with two exceptions, voted to strike it down. Every lower federal court judge appointed by a Democratic president voted to uphold it. There is a drafting error in the Affordable Care Act. It does say that a person gets a tax credit if purchasing insurance from, quote, a state-established exchange. I think that the Obama administration is absolutely right here, that Congress meant to allow tax credits to all who qualify economically, who purchase insurance from exchanges, but the nature of the problem stems from the drafting of this one phrase in a 2,600-page law.
So in this Washington Post ABC poll, the disconnect appears to be that the majority who oppose the law and nearly equal minority does not want the Supreme Court to rule against it. And this is driven by both independents and Republicans. And independents oppose the law 56% to 35%, but they also want the ruling in favor of subsidies by almost exactly that same margin. And likewise, only 19% of Republicans support the law, but 35% say the court should not block subsidies to low and moderate income people. So doesn't this indicate, Erwin Chemerinsky, that if the Supreme Court does strike down Obamacare, we know that the Democrats are really going to be upset, but it would seem to me that they will have a fairly substantial number of independents and Republicans agreeing that the court has overstepped its bounds.
I hope so, because if so, then maybe there's a chance that if the court strikes this down, Congress really could fix it. Because it appears that when millions of people lose their health care coverage, there is no backup plan. There is no plan that either Congress or the states has at this point to provide health care coverage to them. So maybe if the opinion polls are accurate, this could provide the impetus for Congress to make the necessary fix in the statute to make clear that anyone who qualifies economically who purchases insurance from an exchange should get the tax credit.
Well, even Republicans are now going public. The former Republican Senator Olympia Snow said, "I don't ever recall any distinction between federal and state exchanges in terms of the availability of subsidies." So is it possible then, again, going back to my initial question, Erwin Chemerinsky, that I guess there's no way that anybody knows what the decision is, even though the decision's been made. Don't you think the vote's probably been taken by the Supreme Court?
Oh, unquestionably, the justices have decided. They're now in the process of drafting the opinion, and sometime in the next 3 weeks, the decision will be released. The hope is that the Supreme Court will follow common sense, the language of the statute, clear congressional intent, and say that everyone who qualifies economically, who purchases insurance from an exchange, gets a tax credit. But if the court doesn't do that, then I think Congress, even this Congress, needs to fix it.
Well, but that, you're saying that the only way they'll do that is if there's a tremendously mobilized public opinion. And one of the ironies of this is that if this conservative majority on the Supreme Court do strike it down, won't they be handing the Democrats an election year issue?
Well, I have no doubt if the court says that those who purchase insurance from the federal exchanges don't get tax credits, the Democrats are going to need to campaign against Congress and against the Supreme Court, saying millions of people have been hurt because of this silly interpretation of the statute that the Supreme Court accepted.
Well, the thing that I don't understand is why did the Obama administration, they've been terrible at selling Obamacare from day one. Have they not prepared the public in this sense? I mean, I get the feeling that Obama may be starting to prepare the public. I don't know whether he's gotten wind of the decision. I doubt that that's possible. But it just seemed to happen out of the blue today where he made this statement. And I'm wondering whether this is a belated attempt to wake people up. He can't influence the Supreme Court at this point, but all he can do, I guess, is get the American public mobilized.
The Obama administration has done a terrible job of explaining the Affordable Care Act to the American people from the very beginning. That it's never really explained to people that the Affordable Care Act means that no longer can people be denied health insurance because of pre-existing conditions. No longer can those with chronic illnesses be charged more for health insurance. No longer can health insurance companies put a cap on annual or lifetime benefits. I thought the Obama administration should have taken out ads, or had supporters take out ads in the media, write op-eds explaining all of this. I worry if now the Obama administration is trying to explain it all to the American people, it's too little, too late. But that may be what we're hearing today from the president. It may also be just the president expressing frustration that the most important legislative achievement of his presidency now is very vulnerable before the Supreme Court.
Well, in terms of your suggestion, Erwin Chemerinsky, that maybe the Republicans will fix this, to do this one-sentence fix that the president referred to today, Senate Republican number three, John Barrasso of Wyoming, said that, let's be clear, if the Supreme Court rules against the administration, Congress will not pass a so-called one-sentence fake fix. Of course, fake is the word that he inserted there, but... It looks like the lines are pretty clearly drawn here.
I don't think it's likely that Congress will do so. Remember, as you said, the dozens of times that the Republican House of Representatives voted to repeal the entire statute. But also, I'm mindful of the opinion polls that you quoted. If the vast majority of Americans believe that tax credits should be available to all who qualify economically, if the millions of people who are hurt by this have their voices heard, maybe even this Congress might respond.
So what's your opinion of what the president said? I take it you agree with him that they should never have taken this up. I've been getting a lot of mail about it from conservative lawyers and others who've tried to make the argument, but I can never figure out what it is. And then when you look at the genesis of how this suit came to be, it's somewhat like Citizens United, where a political activist, David Bossi, brought that very narrow case about a documentary he made trashing Hillary Clinton, and that was blown up into a huge deal known as we all know, it's changed the entire campaign finance in the country. And we know from the that the Supreme Court shopping case of the Second Amendment in Washington, D.C., created a very radical or a huge change in the Second Amendment ruling. So there's a history of Supreme Court shopping. And this King versus Burwell case seems to be a classic case where conservative activists, Republicans, and libertarians literally went around looking for people, and they had to sort of like casting a movie. They had to find people, and apparently some of the people they found later said, wait a minute, this is not what we really intended. So it just seems so fraudulent to me what's happening here.
But remember, both liberals and conservatives look for plaintiffs so as to be the named individuals bringing the lawsuit. I think the argument that the court shouldn't have taken is a more technical one. The United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit ruled in favor of the Obama administration. The D.C. Circuit was considering a case as to whether or not to rule against the Obama administration. Everyone thought the D.C. Circuit would come to the same conclusion as the Fourth Circuit and rule in favor of the Obama administration. The Supreme Court doesn't take issues until there's a split among the federal courts. But the Supreme Court went ahead and took this anyway. And I think that's the technical reason why people said, why did the court get involved at this stage?
Well, Erwin Chemerinsky, are you a betting man? What's your sense here?
I read the transcript of the oral argument, and it's very hard to predict based on it. In part, that's because John Roberts said only two things in the entire oral argument, and one is a sarcastic quip. But I am by nature an optimist. I'm a lifelong Chicago Cubs fan, so I'm going to predict that the Supreme Court's going to rule in favor of the Obama administration. It's going to follow what the statute says. Anyone who qualifies economically gets a tax credit, and Obamacare will be saved. But that's my optimism speaking much more than any knowledge that I have about what's going to happen.
Well, stay tuned. That's all we can say, I guess. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Anytime.
Thank you, Erwin. Again, I've been speaking with Erwin Chemerinsky, who's a founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California, and his books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest, The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the role that the Kurdish party in Turkey took in thwarting President Erdogan's plans to become the all-powerful leader of Turkey. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edmund Garib, who's an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and Iraq. He was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University, and formerly was a professor at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and the University of Virginia. His books include The Kurdish Question in Iraq, The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, and War in the Gulf, which he co-authored with Majid Haduri. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edmund Garib.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And Edmund, what did you make of this surprise upset in the Turkish parliamentary elections where President Erdogan was rebuked by his countrymen, or at least a majority, not a majority, but enough?
Certainly, this was a watershed event. It's a heavy blow against the ambitions of President Erdogan, who had wanted to change the constitution, to transform the system from a parliamentary system of government to a presidential one, whereby the president would have executive powers similar maybe to some of the, maybe even to a certain extent like the United States. Some people have even said like the presidency of Putin in Russia. And so there's no doubt that the results of this election have set that back. A message has been sent to President Erdogan that the Turkish public is not very happy with many of his policies, be they internal or external. And they were very much concerned, actually, about the checks and balances within the Turkish government and the way things were moving. There were a number of events and factors which contributed to the defeat. Some of it had to do with issues dealing with corruption, which included high-level members of his government, but even other members of his family. There were also the exclusion of the former President Abdullah Gül, who was considered a more moderate figure and had very good relations with other political parties and political forces. The White Elephant Project of the 1,001 rooms, palace, and then when he was asked about that, he said there were cockroaches in the other palace and the other building. And so in addition to the suppression of the Gezi protests and the failure to reach an accord with the Kurds, that's on the internal level. Also, the decline of the economy to a certain extent, although we must admit that it was Erdogan who really won a lot of support because he improved the living standards of the poor, of the lower middle class, of the middle class in Turkey. He created a very important and effective healthcare system. He, in fact, established that in the beginning and said he wanted zero problems with the neighbors. He wanted to solve problems with all of the neighbors, but things changed. He ended up having problems almost with all of his neighbors. He began to interfere in the internal affairs of some of the neighboring states. One of the stories that really apparently created a storm in Turkey was when the Cumhuriyet newspaper about a week and a half ago, published a story and put a video basically showing that Turkish police had who were inspecting trucks going to Syria that were supposedly carrying medicine and food. They found that there were weapons, and he accused them of he accused the police and raised and the newspaper of revealing secrets and threatened to take them to court for undermining the state. There were also people afterwards who called on Erdogan to be tried, and Davutoglu, the prime minister. So there, this issue also created a lot of problems, but the decline of the economy as a result of some of these policies with the neighbors, as well as the failure to the concern about the increasing authoritarian nature of the system, I think may have been some, at least, of the factors which contributed to the results we saw.
But what you just told us, Edmund Garib, about the journalist breaking the story and showing video that trucks going from Turkey into Syria supposedly carrying medicine were in fact carrying arms, and then when this was revealed, the President Erdogan tried to make these people traitors, somehow betraying state secrets. Doesn't this get to the real problem, that he does seem to be supporting the Islamic State in spite of the catastrophe that they have created in Syria? And you saw all that at Kobani when it was under siege, the Kurdish town on the border with Turkey that was under siege by the Islamic State, who had, you know, perfectly prepared and ready to murder everybody. And it was only because of U.S. airstrikes, and it was very clear at the time that the Turkish authorities were not helping the outgunned Kurds.
Exactly. I think that's at least what you said is an excellent analysis of some of the issues that contributed to this problem. There were many in Turkey, in the region, even Europe, Chancellor Merkel, even Vice President Biden talked about weapons and fighters going across the border into Syria and Iraq, and expressing concern about that, whether the Turks were really looking the other way or were not doing their job or what was going on. But then I think the point that you mentioned about Kobani was also extremely important, because at one point he said there is no difference between the Kurds and their militia that was fighting against ISIS in Kobani. There was no difference between them and ISIS, and he did not lift a finger, basically, or the Turkish authority did not lift a finger to help. And as you correctly pointed out, it ended up that the militias, the Kurdish militias, the YPD, were fighting with ISIS, and they did get ultimately support also from the coalition, which helped to bomb and force ISIS out of that region. So that contributed actually a great deal. It angered the Kurds inside Turkey. One thing that I think we should remember, in the past, Erdogan won the support of religious conservative Kurds. In fact, several cities in the southeast were taken over by the AKP, which is Erdogan's party. But I think the policies in Kobani angered and frustrated a lot of Kurds, including some of those who had voted in the past for the ACT party. And so as a result of this, I think we began to see, and what happened was this breakthrough by the Democratic People's Party, which is the first Kurdish party to enter the Turkish parliament. So this is a very significant. This is the first time in modern Turkey's history, and actually Turkish history period, that you see a Kurdish party reaching the parliament. And they won. They got somewhere close to 13%. We have to wait until we see the final official results later, but everybody thinks it was somewhere around 13% of the votes, and that is going to guarantee them at least somewhere 75 to 80 member seats in the parliament. So this is going to play a very, very major role in the balance, the political balance inside Turkey. And so this is going to be a significant change, especially for the Kurds in Turkey.
Well, the 10% was, of course, the threshold, and the People's Democratic Party, as you say, got at least 13%. But I think a part of that was that the People's Democratic Party was founded as a pro-Kurdish party in 2012, and there are 15 million Kurds in Turkey, which is 20% of the population. But you mentioned Kobani, but also the party has attracted support from the political left in Turkey and from secularists and liberals. And it's also fielded in this election that just happened on the weekend, the only openly gay candidate in Turkey's elections, and there's also a higher proportion of women ran with the People's Democratic Party than any other parties. So its appeal is going beyond the Kurdish constituency.
Absolutely. I think this is a very, very important point, what you just mentioned. I mean, they won. There was a question whether or not they're going to get above the 10% of the vote. Because in Turkey, in order to be represented in the parliament, you have any political party has to get at least 10% of the national vote. In the past, Kurdish parties, different parties, other parties, which were not able to cross that threshold, were excluded. And their votes actually went to the other parties, especially most of them went to the majority party, so the largest party. So now what we ended up seeing is that this Kurdish party received, as you correctly pointed out, votes from liberals, from secularists, from non-Kurdish minorities, be they Muslim, such as the Alawis, who many of whom supported for the Kurdish party, as well as Christian minorities. They did support also some of them, many of them, in fact, this party, as well as he also reached out to the gay and lesbian movement groups and individuals in Turkey. He also pushed for women's rights. He called for the advancement of women's rights, and so we ended up seeing many women. The suppression, actually, and attacks on some of the party's headquarters also in recent weeks have basically turned away some of the people who in the past supported Erdogan, although we don't know for sure who was behind these attacks. But many people saw the attack on this party was an effort to deny them votes, and in fact they won sympathy votes. What's interesting about this and what's so significant is that they now, they received most of the votes in 13 provinces in the Kurdish regions in the southeast. And what does this mean? This means now this party has the majority control on the areas that border Armenia, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. So basically, this is a clear message, a very important message right now to the ruling government and the ruling party. And we're going to see what's going to happen. Is Erdogan and his party, are they going to reach out to this party or maybe to other parties to try to establish a coalition government, because it's going to be difficult to form a minority government. I think probably after the official tally comes out, he's going to call on Prime Minister Davutoğlu, although some people think he may be pushed aside, but I'm not sure that that's what's going to happen. But he's going to call on him to form a government. If he can't form a minority government, he's going to try to reach to the other parties to form a coalition government. And that's going to depend on which parties he's going to be able to form a coalition government with. He can form a majority government with any of the other parties, the three parties, which include the Republican People's Party, which is a secularist, nationalist party, and also with the nationalist, Turkish Nationalist Party, which is the nationalist movement, or with the Kurdish party. There might be an effort even to rise to establish a government which would include all of these, but there are too many differences, ideological, political, intellectual, to a certain extent maybe even ethnic, because some parties, such as the Nationalist Party, may not want to form a coalition government with the Kurdish Party. So that it's going to be a fascinating and very interesting period during the next 45 days, because if they don't form a government within 45 days or 25 days after the last after votes are taken and you have an official tally, then there might be a call for a new election.
Well, Edmund Gariba, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Appreciate it.
Bye. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Edmund Gariba, who's an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds. He was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University, and formerly was a professor at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and the University of Virginia. And his books include The Kurdish Question in Iraq, The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, and War in the Gulf, which he co-authored with Majid Haduri. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the results of the G7 summit that just concluded in the Bavarian Alps. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Kellerman, who is the Jean Monnet Chair, Director of the Center for European Studies, and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. He's the author of two books, Eurolegalism, The Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union, and The Rules of Federalism, Institutions and Regulatory Policy in the EU and Beyond. He serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of European Public Policy and West European Politics, and is a former member of the Executive Committee of the European Union Studies Association. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Kellerman.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And the G7 meeting is underway in the idyllic Bavarian castle. And obviously, the absence of Russia, the G8, or the eighth that made up the G8, is fairly strongly felt. It also seems that beyond the fact that Germany is hosting the event, it does seem that Germany is really assuming a much more assertive role, and the British are sort of eclipsing themselves. I think in part due to David Cameron's ridiculous agreement to have a referendum on whether or not the British stay in the EU.
Yeah, no, that's true. Certainly we've seen over the last couple of years a sort of retreat of British influence on the world stage and an increase in German influence, and the referendum is just one of many factors driving that. But certainly at this summit, Merkel seems very much to be in the driver's seat and at the center of a lot of the key issues, the issues with Russia, the issues of climate change especially.
Well, in terms of climate change, one of the ironies is I'm talking to you from Southern California, where we have nothing but sun and a severe drought to boot. Germany has very little sun, and yet it has an extraordinary amount of solar and wind energy. At one point, the 50% of the grid in Germany was powered by both solar and wind. And I think the area where they're meeting has more solar than the entire United States. Am I correct?
Bavaria does, certainly, if you take the region, more than is installed in the U.S. And Germany, I mean, that reflects a deep-seated commitment of Germany to renewables and to the fight against climate change. And that German commitment, Germany's really been the driver then over the years of getting the EU to take on that kind of commitment at the EU level, applying to other member states as well, right? So then that's translated into the EU becoming the sort of global leader in these efforts to secure a climate deal. And in fact, on the climate issues they discussed today at the G7, those are really just a warm-up for the big UN summit on climate change, which will take place in Paris in December. And that's really what Merkel is trying to do, is set a stage for EU leadership at that summit.
And it set a goal for ending fossil fuel consumption by the end of the century. And already Germany is phasing out its nuclear power plants, which some environmentalists have drunk the Kool-Aid to suggest that somehow that's a better alternative because nuclear plants don't create CO2. That's pretty remarkable already, isn't it, what Germany's been doing?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, Germany is certainly a leader, but we should keep in mind it's done. The climate policy under German leadership is set then at the EU level, and they've set up these targets already. They had earlier targets for 2020 reductions they would make. They then took the next step, having these long-range targets for 2030, and then looking further into the century. And what they're really trying to do, though, is to get the rest of the world to come along, because, you know, there's a realization that the sort of slice of the global pie and the slice of that is made up by Europe is growing smaller over time as, you know, the other economies grow in relative terms. And what that means is that whatever Europe does, right, won't stop the problems of climate change. They can only really have the effect they want if they can get the U.S., and then, you know, crucially, get the developing countries like China, India, and others on board as well. But certainly they're trying to lead by example and committing themselves to it already.
So what do you think President Obama, who we know wants to do something about climate change, what does it say about the ability of the Germans, notwithstanding what you just told us, what their broader agenda is, that they can get things done and we can't?
Well, I think in the U.S. the story is quite simple, really, that it's largely a partisan story that, yes, the administration here and the Democratic Party, there's pretty broad support for action on climate change. That being said, there's some Democrats from coal states and places like that that are more reluctant. But on the other side of the aisle, there's really great opposition to action on climate change from Republicans in Congress. And basically that means that, you know, any deal, even if in this Paris summit, any sort of UN deal that the administration might try to sign on to, Congress is already signaling that it would be dead on arrival, you know, in the Senate. And so Obama's busy trying to craft ways he might be able to sign some deal that wouldn't count as a treaty or something, so it wouldn't have to be ratified. But, you know, essentially what it says is that our system, as in so many other areas, is gridlocked between these two parties, and that on this issue, a lot of the Republican Party just doesn't even buy into the science on climate change, much less taking costly actions to address it.
So the other issue on the agenda, apart from climate change, of course, has been Russia. And I mentioned at the opening that Russia used to be in the G8, and it's absent from this meeting because of what President Obama refers to as Russian aggression in Ukraine. And it does seem that at the meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, the White House said that the leaders agreed that the duration of the sanctions should be clearly linked to Russia's full implementation of the Minsk agreement. It does seem that with Angela Merkel being, I think, one of the few leaders in the world that seems to have an ability to talk with Vladimir Putin. And clearly, President Obama and Putin used to talk a lot on the phone for a long, long time. Apparently, a lot of the time was taken up by Obama having to listen to Putin's arguments. But now I don't think he even wants to talk to him. So what's your sense of that relationship between these two nuclear-armed states seems to be hanging by a thread. So how much is Angela Merkel engaged still, or is she giving up on Putin too?
Well, yeah, I don't know if giving up is exactly the right word, but she's definitely come along to a very hard-line stance, you know, along with the Americans on that. And I think, in a way, the agreement on the sanctions on Russia was the biggest success of this G7 summit, more than the action on climate change, because there they agreed to kind of some vague targets and not sort of any actions that require immediate legislation to be passed or anything really concrete. Whereas on the sanctions, you know, this is an issue where if we go back when the sanctions were first put in place against Putin over the incursion in Ukraine, a lot of people thought, oh, this sanction regime won't hold. There'll be a division between the U.S. and its European allies. People were arguing the Germans and others in Europe are too dependent on the Russian gas, et cetera, to stick with this sanctions regime. And yet we've seen that the sanctions regime has held together, that, in fact, Europeans have toughened their line, and Merkel in particular, who some had thought might, you know, go softer initially. And so this summit, I think, was a huge success in demonstrating that the transatlantic alliance is holding firm against the principle and of Russian violation of the sovereignty of Ukraine and of the idea of violent armed conflict, you know, with neighbors. And so I think that's the big success of the summit, is that they are holding firm on this. And it really is putting pressure on the Putin regime.
Well, it would seem that also there's another shoe that might drop, and it's completely unrelated, I guess, from geopolitics, but it nevertheless is a part of geopolitics, and that is the FIFA scandal that's been uncovered. There is serious talk now that they're going to be revisiting the 2018 World Cup that was awarded to Russia, not to mention the 2022 World Cup that was awarded to Qatar. So that, I think...
I'm more a consumer of news than an expert, but following it as you have yourself. But I think certainly the geopolitics will be dragged into that situation, even though it's, you know, a matter of sport, because, you know, essentially, I think we can expect that if there are more revelations of, you know, bribes being handed over in the award of those two World Cups, and if then, as some in the FIFA, some FIFA executives have indicated, that would be cause for sort of reconsidering the location of the games. Well, then, of course, Russia and those that stand by it will argue that this is, you know, punishment for the situation in Ukraine, and, you know, you could easily imagine, you know, boycotts and that sort of thing, as we've seen in past Olympics and that. So, yeah, I think that those, in particular, the games with Russia, if it does come up, it will be linked to this broader growing geopolitical tension between the West and Russia.
But in terms of whether Putin is going to buckle under sanctions or double down, which is a lot of what the recent military analysts have been saying, that Putin is preparing for a military offensive. On the other hand, Putin recently went on television and said that it would be crazy for Russia to have a war with NATO. They have no intention. So what kind of needle is he threading there, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think what he's threading there is, you know, that on the one hand, in the short term, his aggression in the Ukraine and his support for the separatists there is very popular in Russia, and that's buoyed his regime in the face of sort of dismal economic performance lately. So he's gotten people to rally around the kind of nationalist flag and to ignore their economic plight, which might otherwise reduce their support for his regime. That being said, you know, that kind of approach, I think, is only sustainable so long, because the sanctions regime, along with the low price of oil, you know, that's been hurting the economy, and you know, Russian consumers, I think, will be eventually grow tired of this, the pain they're having to take for this, and start questioning, you know, how much they're paying in various ways for this involvement in Ukraine.
So on the other issue that was discussed at the G7 is, of course, the Greek debt situation and whether or not Greece will leave the Eurozone. And Chancellor Merkel said that time is running out for the Greeks to make the deal. There again, there seems to be some brinksmanship.
Yeah, certainly. And then also, since we were just talking about Russia, it's worth noting that that sort of gets the situations get connected because there is a sort of geopolitical fear. I personally don't think it's very well founded. People try to push the idea that if the Eurozone really cuts off Greece and if they are pressured eventually to exit the Euro, that they might then turn to Russia for assistance and this sort of thing. So the two situations get linked a bit that way. But yes, time really is running out. There's no question there. To make a very long and complicated story short, Greece simply does not have the money to make the debt payments it owes to the IMF and other creditors this month, let alone in July and August when it owes even more to other creditors like the European Central Bank. And so the only way that the Greek government can make the payments to the International Monetary Fund that it owes this month is if the Eurozone creditors release the last, they call it a tranche, the last pool of money in the bailout. Now, they've been withholding that money that was part of the Greek bailout because they say Greece has not met the conditions it had promised in terms of reform. And so they're saying, well, you have to show us that you're moving forward on these reforms we've demanded or else you can't have any more of our money. And the Greeks are saying, well, you know, you can't afford to let us explode, and these reforms you're suggesting are crazy and too painful for us. So, like you say, it's brinksmanship. They're sort of playing a game of chicken where the Greeks are thinking that the Europeans won't really take the risk of letting their economy completely implode and seeing them leave the euro. So it's coming down to the wire literally in the next week or so.
But isn't there a bit of an irony here, Daniel Kellerman, that while the Europeans are hammering the Greeks and threatening to cut off funds or at least not finance any more bailouts, they seem to be throwing money at Ukraine, which is an even greater bottomless pit. If you think the Greeks are irresponsible financially, Ukraine is a total economic basket case with no transparency. And yet,
well, that's a good point. They're both basket cases, but I think the volumes of money are so substantially higher in Greece that makes it a kind of categorically different situation. And also Greece, you know, although it's having a huge crisis, a depression, by any measure, is not currently being invaded by another country. So I think that's one difference in the comparison. But, the thing I'd say also on the Greek situation, what makes it so tough is you have two sort of principles set out against each other, which are really in tension, which means that both sides of the argument, have a lot of truth in what they're saying. Number one, the Greeks quite rightly say the austerity policies that the Eurozone has demanded that we pursue in the last few years have proven disastrous. So we don't want any more of that. So that's a very legitimate argument to make. On the other hand, from the side of those who've given these bailouts, they say you can't expect to have a blank check, right? And if we give money, then we are going to demand reforms that we think will make sure our money gets repaid. And that's also a very legitimate point, right? And so that's the heart of the tension, really, is that those two things are in conflict right now.
So in terms of other matters on the G7 agenda, I think we've covered most of the important ones, but there have been meetings on the side with Iraq's prime minister and with the leader from Tunisia and the new president of Nigeria. So all of those, I guess, are different subjects, but I take it the one greater fear is, of course, the growth of this Islamic State and the apparent inability of the Iraqi government, not to mention its partners, to really do what they promised to do, which is degrade and destroy them.
Yeah, no, certainly. And this is a key geopolitical risk for all of the G7 countries and certainly for the NATO allies. I think the other thing is that it plays also into there's a sort of domestic angle to this as well, because you have this whole phenomenon where we've had thousands of young Europeans, right, or that have been traveling to join ISIS, right? People that are from communities living within Europe but feel alienated, isolated, and they hear the call of this jihad or of ISIS, and they are going over there. So that's an additional domestic sort of concern in some of the European G7 partners.
So just in closing, I mentioned in the beginning that the British, in a way, have marginalized themselves, and Germany is now assuming a role that it's really had for much longer than it's willing to sort of step up to the plate, if you will, as the dominant power in Europe. But it does seem that much of the self-marginalization of the United Kingdom, at least lately, has been self-inflicted by David Cameron's promise to have a referendum over whether or not Britain will get out of the EU. And surely that undercuts your ability to even have a meeting at the EU, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, certainly that's weakened the British position. The only good thing I can really say about it, and, you know, personally, I sort of welcome the referendum in the sense of, well, let's get this over with finally and just have a decision, because it's a long story beyond what we can talk about here, but the UK has had sort of a one-foot-in, one-foot-out attitude about the EU since the beginning, really. And I think this referendum, you know, could sort of settle the matter a bit more decisively. And the polling numbers, by the way, look very good right now, that a substantial majority of Britons in polls are suggesting they'll vote to remain within the EU, right, when the referendum comes, which has to be by 2017. And, you know, I think on top of that, you know, there's all these as the full consequences of the referendum are spinning out, becoming obvious to everyone. For instance, the Scots have said, well, if you're going to have a referendum and if the voters would vote to leave the European Union, then we're going to have a second Scottish referendum, and then, you know, we're really going to leave the UK this time around, right? So all those things put together, I think, are really making more and more Britons think that this idea of leaving the EU, while it might make for good rhetoric sometimes, it's really bad for our economy. It could be bad for the whole integrity of our country sticking together. And so they're, I think, going to reject that idea, and then maybe we can get this behind us.
Well, just in closing, of course, the Prime Minister has announced that he wants to renegotiate the EU membership, and he's infuriated his backbenchers by saying that they're all on board when they're clearly not. And that Merkel has said that she welcomes the British renegotiation. So I suppose there's some wiggle room there, right?
Yeah, although so far, when he talks about renegotiation, he said very little of anything specific, right? He said they want, you know, a more efficient EU, an EU that's not so intrusive, et cetera. But when you get down to specifics, we really haven't heard what Cameron and his government want. And so we'll see, and European partners will be happy to accommodate them with some kind of reforms, and they'd probably agree with them on many issues. So I think there'll be room to make, you know, some kind of reforms and accommodations for this so-called renegotiation. But I can tell you that won't satisfy the most Eurosceptic or, you know, anti-EU members of the Conservative Party, those backbenchers you mentioned. And so, as has happened before in British history, I think in the end this might cause a real rupture within the Conservative Party in the next 2 years. And that's something Cameron has to bear in mind, knowing how the issues of European integration have sort of doomed previous prime ministers.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Daniel Kellerman.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Kellerman, who's a Jean Monnet Chair, Director of the Center for European Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. He's the author of Eurolegalism, the Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union, and The Rules of Federalism, Institutions and Regulatory Politics in the EU and Beyond. He serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of European Public Policy and West European Politics, and is a former member of the Executive Committee of the European Union Studies Association. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was mine.